Good day. Today is Thursday, 26th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, today, 26th March 2026, I saw an article in the Daily Telegraph in London, which I think sums up exactly the current situation in the conflict in the Middle East, which is that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, is running out of time. Now, this article was mostly based around a very interesting report by the Royal United Services Institute in Britain, which discussed the state of various inventories of US weapons within the US military system. And, well, it was all very interesting. And it said, essentially, that ATACMS missiles, apparently used heavily by the United States in this conflict, the stockpile has depleted by 46%. And will in effect run out by the 12th of April, that TAD air defense missiles, the stockpile has depleted by 40% and will run out entirely by the 17th of April, that JASSMs missiles, cruise missiles, those mostly used by the US bombers that have been conducting strikes against Iran, the stockpile there has depleted by 26% and will have depleted to critical levels by the 8th of May. That Aegis-type missiles, as used by US Navy destroyers, the stockpile there has depleted by 17% and will run out by the 8th of June. The Tomahawk missile arsenal has depleted by 17% and will run out by the 11th of June. The Patriot missile arsenal has depleted by 16%. And will run out by the 15th of June, assuming, obviously, that the current pace of operations continues, or that pace of operations continues in the same way. And, of course, the cost of the war continues to mount. I've seen a report that the total cost of the military operations that the United States has been conducting against Iran now runs at about $30 billion. By the way, I believe this is a massive underestimate. I'm going to make a shrewd guess that the true amount is about double that, just to say. Sooner or later, one way or the other, the administration is indeed going to have to go back to Congress to ask for further funding. No doubt the current defence budget can be depleted to some extent, and there are all sorts of reserves and other funds sloshing around the system which can be redeployed by the US Treasury Secretary and his officials to sustain the war. But there are limits to how long this can be done. And at some point, if the conflict continues, inevitably, the administration is going to have to ask to make a formal funding request to Congress. And I'm going to guess that it is going to be substantially above the $200 billion that some people have been talking about over the last couple of days. So yes, weapons, high precision weapons, are indeed reducing. An article in the Daily Telegraph that looked at the Royal United Services Institute report spoke about how the United States could, in theory, obviously, continue the war, even if all of these weapon systems that I've just discussed, the Tomahawks, the TADs, the JASSMs, the ATACMs, even if all of them have been depleted completely. But doing so would expose US military personnel to far greater risks. It would require them to conduct operations much closer to Iranian military positions, where they might become vulnerable. There was an article earlier today in the Financial Times which spoke about the further military assistance that Iran is receiving from Russia. It spoke about how the Russians are sending convoys of trucks with supplies to Iran, some of which, interestingly, have been passing apparently unimpeded through Azerbaijan, even though Azerbaijan has been an ally of Israel. But anyway, the convoys are getting through. Obviously, there's food and other humanitarian goods in these convoys. But according to the Financial Times, and this is apparently based upon Western intelligence estimates, the Russians have been providing Iran with drone technology, including, by the way, fiber optic drone technology, which the Russians have been using substantially in Ukraine, but which the Iranians, until recently at least, have not had. There was another article that I saw somewhere in the media, again in Britain, that an example of a fiber optic drone, which appeared to have a Russian origin, was found in one of the Gulf states where this drone had impacted. I'm not sure exactly how it got that far, just to say, and I'm not going to push this further. There's all sorts of stories of that kind circulating, and they should be taken with very, very great caution. But anyway, that the Russians are providing the Iranians with drones. But in terms of the issue, the key issue of US forces conducting attacks closer to Russia, to Iranian positions, exposing themselves by coming closer to US, to Iranian positions. Well, this article spoke about a major supply by Russia to Iran of advanced Verba hand-portable man-pads-type air defense missiles. The Russians are apparently supplying these to the Iranians with in large quantities. And if we're talking about ground attack aircraft or aircraft engaged in ground attacks, I can imagine that in the hands of properly trained troops, this would be a significant problem for any American aviation that had to get closer to the Iranian positions. By the way, the Russian Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov was asked to comment about this article, and basically his response was, well, you shouldn't believe everything you read, which is what I would call a non-denial denial. It doesn't actually confirm the truth, but neither does it deny the truth of the story. For the record, since I'm talking about the Financial Times article, the Financial Times article says that Western intelligence has assessed that the Russians have not supplied S-400 air defense missiles to Iran, despite Iranian requests that they do. I have to say that information I have received privately from Russia itself suggests otherwise. There might be a way of reconciling these two contradictory statements. As I've said in the past, I know with great confidence that Russia sold an S-400 missile system to Iran, and that Iranian personnel began training on it in 2024. I have also learnt that the Russians assess that it takes about a year for personnel who train on the S-400 system to know how to use it successfully, though it would take around 2 years of training for optimal proficiency to be achieved. It seems to me you can reconcile these two contradictory statements, the ones I'm getting from within Russia and the Financial Times piece, by speculating that what the Iranians have actually received is the S-400 system they previously bought from the Russians. The Russians have supplied that, but they have refused to supply the Iranians for the time being with any more of these systems. And the reason is very simple. It's because with a shortage of Iranian personnel to operate these systems, the Russians themselves would have to do that. And for the moment, as the Financial Times article confirmed, that is not something that the Russians are willing to do. Anyway, so we could see that there are depletions of American weapon systems. This is what the Royal United Services Institute report says. And this is already creating time limits on how military operations can be conducted. If in a month's time the Americans deplete their stockpiles to the level that they're not able or don't feel able to carry out standoff attacks with long distance weapons, they would have to bring their aircraft closer to the battle, and that would increase risks of casualties. I would add, just on this point, that I cannot imagine that the United States will allow its inventories of advanced weapons to deplete to the kind of levels suggested in the Russi report, for the simple reason that the United States needs these weapons to counter China in the Asia Pacific region. And long before those dates in the Russi report are reached, the United States will start to limit its use of these weapons in this conflict. So we are looking at combat operations that look likely to last less than a month. So that is one time bar, but there are plenty of others. Throughout this week, the United States government has been pulling every stop to try to get the price of oil below $100 a barrel. They've been talking up peace negotiations with the Iranians. They've been saying that the Iranians are in negotiations with them. I pointed out that the president's claim on Monday that there'd been successful negotiations between the United States and Iran over the weekend were entirely fictitious. I think this fact is now all but universally accepted. But the United States continues to float ideas of negotiations. It has talked about a 15-point plan. There have been, as I've discussed in recent programs, many different versions of this 15-point plan apparently floating around. The Iranians are scoffing about this plan. They're not taking it seriously, and they are rejecting negotiations for the time being. But the United States has been talking about negotiations. It's been talking about a ceasefire. And in part, at least, I am sure that they're doing this in order to calm the markets, to try to prevent energy prices going up further. Now, this is a dangerous game because, as a commentator, a member of the Duran community, pointed out in a comment he made on my local live stream last night, if you keep the price of oil lower than it should be, given existing market conditions, all you're going to do is encourage heavy buying by various parties of oil whilst it is at this present existing unsustainable lower price, because many market actors must be anticipating an oil shortage in a few weeks. And that is going to deplete the amount of oil available further and faster than it would otherwise do if the price were actually correlated to supply, which makes the possibility of an actual material oil shortage greater, which could result in a vertical, steep rise in the price when that oil shortage, when those big material gaps in supply start to hit at some point in the summer. This game that the president and the administration have been playing can only succeed if somehow, in some way, the Strait of Hormuz is opened at some point over the next few days. Were that to happen, the tankers that are currently bottled up in the Persian Gulf could leave. That would then increase, if only temporarily, the supply of oil. That would further stabilize markets, and it would buy time whilst the production facilities in the Gulf region were repaired or restored and brought back into production. So it is a gamble, but of course, the longer this gamble is played, the greater the risk that things could start to go very seriously wrong. And already, again, as doubts about the negotiations with the Iranians start to circulate in the market, there are signs once more this morning of energy prices increasing, with oil, just before I started making this program, once again trading at $107 a barrel. Now, There are other effects, other economic effects. As has been pointed out by many people, the Gulf region doesn't only supply oil, it supplies natural gas, 20% of the world's supply, in fact. There is going to be a critical shortage of natural gas. Whatever happens, it will take a long time before the production facilities that have been damaged in Qatar and perhaps in Iran too are back in service. Some estimate that we are looking at around 2 years before the gas production facilities in Qatar are operating again. But of course, there are all sorts of other products that are in short supply as well. Naphtha, fertilizer, which is to a great extent itself a byproduct of the natural gas industry. Fertilizer being absolutely essential in order to maintain global food production. Apparently, roughly 20% of global fertilizer also is exported through the Gulf. The other big producer, by the way, with roughly double the production, incidentally, is Russia. There's an article by the Carnegie Endowment discussing how the Russians might be the people who tried to plug the holes in the global fertilizer market. But of course, the Russians cannot replace overnight 20% of global production. So there are all of these other problems in terms of supplies of critical commodities and goods, and they are intensifying as well. And yesterday, I finally got information which points to potential global supply shocks in terms of other products. I had a meeting 2 days ago with an individual who works in the tungsten industry. He told me that China, which exports around 90% of global supply of tungsten. Very few countries are self-sufficient in tungsten. One of them, again, is Russia, just to say. But it is China that is the big producer. Anyway, the Chinese, as well as restricting, as well as stopping supplies of refined oil products, oil and diesel, upon which the economies of some East Asian states were heavily dependent, that the Chinese are now starting to restrict exports of tungsten and of other strategic materials, and that they have taken the first steps to start restricting again supplies of rare earths. It's not yet as severe as it was in the autumn, but the Chinese are taking the first steps in that direction. Probably as much because they want to build up their own stockpiles in light of a potential global supply crunch of practically everything, as because they want to put pressure on the United States. But of course, if the Chinese are now starting to limit exports of critical materials, that is also going to start to affect the situation in global supply chains as well. And lastly, there is a major financial aspect at play too. Now, the collapse of production and export in the Gulf region is inevitably leading to a mass outflow of funds from the Gulf as investors and high net worth individuals and various companies start to take their funds out of the Gulf, which of course has been one of the regions where for the last 70 or so years, especially the last 50 or so years, capital has been concentrated. Now, once upon a time, most of that capital would have flowed to the United States. But I am told that this is no longer the case. I was informed yesterday that most of this capital is actually flowing to East Asian financial centres, the bulk of it to Hong Kong. The figures I was given, which are startling, is that before the start of this crisis, the level of capital inflow from the Gulf to Hong Kong was between $2 and $4 billion a month. It has now increased to $40 billion a week. Now, that obviously is not going to continue at that level indefinitely, but it again gives a sense of what is happening in global financial markets. And again, the point has been made to me, and again, I'm not making predictions here because I'm not able to make predictions about what happens in global financial markets. But anyway, I am told that if there is a major supply crunch, if there is a stampede, especially in Asia, to get whatever oil and gas and any one of these products is still around, if the Asians enter into a war of supply with the Europeans, also coming into the markets, that is going to oblige governments to start depleting their own financial reserves. A lot of these reserves are held in treasuries, US treasuries. There could be a fire sale of treasuries, perhaps by the autumn, if there is still by that time a genuine worry that the war is going to drag on, and if there's been no resolution of the crisis before then. Now, again, I am not an expert in any one of these fields. I am simply reporting what I have been told. The facts about rising energy costs there are, however, for anyone to see. There are already reports that in Greece, the first steps are being taken towards energy rationing, and the OECD is reporting economic declines in Europe and is saying that my own country, Britain, looks particularly vulnerable and exposed in this crisis. And I'm also hearing from friends in the United States about steadily increasing prices at the gas stations. Things have not yet reached the point that they did in the summer of 2022. But then we are only a few weeks into this crisis. Quite plausibly, things would get worse, given that we are looking at a supply shock on a scale that we have never seen since the end of the Second World War. Despite the fact that the United States remains an oil producer and a gas producer, it seems to me difficult to imagine a situation where prices at the pumps are not going to rise and rise to extraordinary levels. So I don't know how much of this information is being provided to the president himself. There is an extremely disturbing story on NBC, which, by the way, I have not seen convincingly denied or contradicted, that the president gets his ideas about the state of the war with Iran from a 2-minute video that he's provided by the Joint Chiefs of Staff every evening. This video is a compilation of successful strikes on Iranian targets. And the effect of this video supposedly is to put the president in a state of euphoria so that he imagines that things are going better on the battlefield than they really are. If there is truth to this story, and to say again, I have not seen it convincingly denied or contradicted, then obviously it speaks very badly for the president himself. I've read in several places about considerable frustration at various levels of the US government, including the intelligence community, that reports that are sent to the president, some of them very short, some of them only 3 pages long, just to say, are never read by him. That he basically does not take the trouble to read reports and memos that are placed before him, which inevitably is going to cause him to lose touch with the situation and to rely overmuch on what he is told by the people he is speaking to. But anyway, it's a very bad situation in terms of the president himself choosing to lead the United States in the middle of a conflict in that kind of way. But I have to also say, it is, if this story is true, it is a terrible commentary on the quality of the US's military leadership, that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, instead of insisting on proper meetings with the president in order to brief him properly and thoroughly about the state of the war, are instead providing a 2-minute video and are leaving it at that. It suggests that something is very wrong, not just in terms of the political leadership of the Department of War or the Department of Defense, of Pete Hegseth and company, but of the senior military officers on the Joint Chiefs of Staff as well. But anyway, I don't know how well briefed or well informed the president is about this situation. It's also said that he spends an enormous amount of time getting his views, forming his views, and getting his information from Fox, which is a television channel and perhaps not the best place to go. Apparently, alongside Lindsey Graham and various other people, he has been heavily influenced, or at least this is what the reports claim, by the owner of Fox, Rupert Murdoch, who apparently has been one of the people who have been most insistent in advocating this conflict with Iran. Rupert Murdoch, of course, does not have the kind of intelligence information or access to the kind of classified information that one would expect the President of the United States to do, Or at least that is what one would hope. So he may not be a wise or proper counsellor at this time. Just saying. But anyway, I don't know how well informed the president is, but he must be aware at some level at least of two things. Firstly, the price of energy is rising. This is causing political pressures within the United States. I've seen multiple opinion polls which speak about a major disaster pending for the Republicans in the midterm elections. And I cannot imagine that the president, who has survived two impeachment attempts, can be complacent about that. So that is one thing that I presume the president does know. And he must know something else, which is that the regime change, which he was undoubtedly led to believe would happen following the attack on Iran, has not so far taken place. Now, I've had some pushback about this. There's been some who suggested that, in fact, the objective never was regime change. To my mind, that is plainly contradicted by the president's own statements in the early days of the war, including his extraordinary statement demanding unconditional surrender from Iran. In fact, it would be useful to dial back and read some of the things the president said, both during the June 2025 war and at the start of this one, and that he has been seeking regime change in Iran. Well, to me, that is a matter beyond any possible doubt. But beyond what he has said, there is the way in which the war has been conducted. Wars that begin with decapitation strikes that target Iranian leaders are obviously and plainly intended to create a political crisis leading to the eventual overthrow of the government. And the president, however poorly briefed he is about all of the things that I discussed at the start of this program, must know that this desired regime change that he gambled upon when he started this war has so far failed to take place. Now, before this war happened, on the Duran, we repeatedly made a very simple point that despite the enormous power of the United States and the relatively far less power of Iran, the United States is not configured for a long war. Its military is not structured in that way. We, on many programs over the course of the Ukraine war, Brian Beletic on his channel as well, we've pointed out to the many well-known problems with military production in Europe and in the United States. The US military is not configured for long wars. The US economy is not configured for long wars. This is not something that the United States recently has been called upon to do, and it is not structured to do it. Whereas, if Iran survives the initial strikes, if the government there retains control, if it is able to consolidate and increase control, if it is able to continue fighting, then Iran potentially can draw the United States into a war of attrition, precisely the kind of war which, as I said, the United States is not configured to fight and which it would wish to avoid. Whereas for Iran, a war of attrition works overwhelmingly to its advantage. And that with every day of the war, when there is no regime change in Iran, Iran's position becomes relatively stronger, whereas the position of the United States becomes relatively weaker. And that, it seems to me, was a completely accurate assessment of the situation which we made on the Duran before the start of the war. And it determines the calculus that we are now seeing. So the president knows that there's been no regime change. He senses, he must sense, however ill-informed he is, that the United States is in a long-drawn-out or potentially long-drawn-out war of attrition, which politically and economically it's not ready for. So what does he do? Well, over the course of this week, we have seen the president and his officials seek to do two completely contradictory things at one and the same time. On the one side, they are clearly trying to lure the Iranians into negotiations. But the negotiations that they have in mind are not good faith negotiations, any more than the previous negotiations, the ones that took place before the June 2025 war and this current war, were good faith negotiations. The president appears to be shunting Witkoff and Kushner to one side. He says that he's bringing forward new negotiators, new, more serious negotiators, J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio. But the demands that the United States appears to be making are essentially a reversion to the demands that the United States made before the start of the conflict, demands for an end to nuclear enrichment by Iran, the essential destruction of Iran's ballistic missile capability, proposals which, of course, the Iranians rejected, and which, following the start of the war, they are even more likely to reject. And provided the United States continues to make demands of this kind, I cannot see that there is any possibility at all that the Iranians will be tempted back into further negotiations. And well, we've had, in fact, a list now of Iranian demands. They've been set out by Larry Johnson on his Sonar 21 blog. Complete halt to aggression and assassination. Iran demands an immediate and total end to US Israeli attacks, strikes, and targeted killings against Iranian territory, officials, nuclear sites, and allied resistance forces, including Hezbollah in Lebanon. Guarantees and mechanisms to prevent future attacks, war, which would include extended concrete, verifiable international or legal safeguards that the war will not be reimposed. These could include binding agreements or frameworks ensuring no resumption of hostilities. war reparations and compensation for damage caused, recognition of Iranian sovereignty and control over the Strait of Hormuz, and possibly also the various further demands that have already been talked about, a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, continued development of Iran's ballistic missile program without external limitations, an end to the conflict across all fronts involving resistance groups. Also, apparently, talk about the closure of all US bases in the Middle East. Now, those kind of demands, presented in that way, are Iranian demands which, if accepted, would undoubtedly be seen in the United States and around the world as the United States accepting a defeat, and they would create a political, a geopolitical revolution in the Middle East on a scale that we have not seen since the 1920s. It would be, in effect, the end of Western influence in the Middle East. And the geopolitical implications would not merely be limited to the Middle East. They would obviously have massive global repercussions as well. So understandably, given that these appear to be at least some of the Iranian demands, I mean, the Iranians might be willing to negotiate around some of them, but this is the kind of things that they're talking about at the moment. The president clearly doesn't want to come away from a negotiation and agree to something like this. So what does he do? And this is where we come back to this whole issue of a ground operation in the Gulf. And there are now accumulating reports that the first units of the 82nd Airborne Division have arrived on the scene. There's more talks about some kind of US ground operation being prepared. There was a briefing of members of Congress. Some of those members of Congress were deeply upset by what they heard. One of them, Representative Mansi, stormed out of the meeting in shock and said that basically she was horrified by what she had heard there, and that the plans that were being discussed appalled her, and that she obviously opposes them. She, by the way, blamed Lindsey Graham for what is happening. And it's perhaps important to say that Representative Mansi is a Republican from South Carolina, which is, of course, the state where Lindsey Graham represents in the Senate, just to say. So apparently many members of Congress were horrified. Others, of course, are more supportive. But there are comments circulating around that no really clear, definable plan was presented, just some kind of ground operation with hope that if it takes place, it will achieve some kind of success and will be sufficient to tip the Iranians into capitulating in the kind of way that the president wants by agreeing to something like his 15-point plan. Well, I, of course, was not at that briefing. I don't know what the plan that was discussed was. There is and continues to be massive speculation that the plan is to capture Chark Island. Senator Graham is indeed very busy saying that the capture of Chark Island would be the coup de grace, the blow that would break Iran. It would leave the United States basically in control of Iran's oil export industry. There are other claims, speculations that the United States might be intending to seize some of the islands in the Strait of Hormuz. There's some speculations that the United States might be thinking of doing both things, seizing both some of these islands in the Strait of Hormuz and seizing Chark Island as well. There's further reports that there's plans to conduct some kind of operation on the Iranian coast to capture an Iranian port. I'm not quite sure what that would achieve. Anyway, there's lots of ideas of this kind floating around. Now, I am not a military expert, as I've discussed many times. And I have to say that it is not obvious to me what any of this would actually achieve that would alter the strategic calculus of the war. I don't understand why seizing Chark Island or some islands on the Strait of Hormuz would in themselves be sufficient, for example, to cause ships that are bottled up in the Persian Gulf to risk transit through the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranians would still have drones, maybe fiber optic drones supplied to them by the Russians. They would still have missiles. It's clear that the Iranians went into this war with many, many more missiles than the Americans and the Israelis anticipated. There are now reports which have appeared in the US media and which have allegedly been confirmed by US officials that the Iranians have now started planting mines in the Persian Gulf. Not so far in enormous quantities. Most likely this is a warning or a signal of some kind. But perhaps it is a warning that should be heeded given the advice provided by British naval captains and other naval people that neither the British Navy nor, more importantly, the US Navy are really best configured to deal with mines in the confined waters of the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. So, I don't understand what the seizure of these islands would achieve. And moreover, I read a long article about the potential pitfalls of an operation to capture Chark Island in the Financial Times. The article said that, yes, it could be done. There would be significant losses. The Iranians would undoubtedly bombard and conduct strikes against Chark Island, and that would no doubt lead to more losses. The authors of the article believed that nonetheless, a US force could hold on in Chark Island and presumably any other island that the US captures. And though there would be losses and casualties, it could be retained. But it also said that protecting the American forces on Chark Island, protecting the US forces presumably also in any other island that the US captured, that would then become the central priority of the US forces that are currently engaging Iran. And that would mean that aircraft and missiles would have to be diverted from operations against Iran itself and refocused to trying to protect these American forces on these islands. In which case, well, you could argue that the mighty American military is being diverted from the kind of strategic task it is created to fulfill in order to protect or preserve American positions in what are otherwise tiny islands. Besides, would the capture of Kharg Island or another island in the Strait of Hormuz really change things in Tehran? The Iranians lost significant amounts of territory during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, but that didn't cause them to stop fighting. On the contrary, it caused them to intensify fighting. I made this point in previous programs. The Iranians are also now saying that they have received information that the United States does indeed intend to conduct operations against one particular island. Doesn't say which one. They say also that they understand that the United States is getting assistance from one of the Persian Gulf states to conduct this operation. That if this operation is carried out, they will conduct devastating strikes against that Persian Gulf state. There's speculation that it is the UAE which lays claim to some of the islands in the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians currently control and which the Americans might be thinking of capturing. The Iranians have shown that they have a proven capability to devastate the oil industry of the UAE. But of course, they could do more, much more if it escalates into an all-out war. They could start attacking the desalination plants. Cities like Dubai and Abu Dhabi might become uninhabitable. And well, again, would the seizure of these islands, were it done, would it really change anything in the war? Might it not, in fact, intensify it and escalate it further? Now, to give an example, the Houthis in Yemen have up to now held back from joining the war because, as they point out, they have a long-standing, well, they have a recent agreement with Saudi Arabia that they and Saudi Arabia will not attack each other. This after the failure of Saudi Arabia's own operations against the Houthis that took place over the last 10 years or so. But that calculus might change if there is some kind of an attack on Iran, which involves the series, which involves attacks on and seizures of Iranian territory. Might the Houthis in that case not decide that since seizure of territory is now what is being done, this is indeed the moment for them to enter the war, to conduct strikes against the Saudi ports on the Red Sea, to attack the pipelines, which is well within their capabilities to do? Might that not start to happen? And, well, there are potentials for further escalation. There's already difficult attritional fighting going on in Lebanon. And there are many reports, not always easy for me to work out, about a major deterioration in the American military position in Iraq, that there's been attacks, or at least harassment, of the remaining US bases in Iraq, that the United States has made a decision to withdraw all its forces from Iraq. There was some kind of American attack, or so the Iraqis say, upon an Iraqi military formation. The Iraqi government has called in the US ambassador to deliver a strong protest note. It looks as if the whole American position in Iraq is unraveling. I say the whole American position. It is likely that the Americans and their allies have separately some kind of presence in Iraqi Kurdistan, which is presumably less affected. But, well, to go back to previous discussions, if there's still plans to activate the Kurds or to conduct some sort of operations against Iran via Iraqi Kurdistan, then it seems to me that the ability to do that is going to be massively complicated if the government in Baghdad and Iraq altogether is hostile to operations of that kind. So anyway, maybe I am missing something. Again, as I said, I am not a military person. I know many military people do follow these programs. If I am missing something, please write to me. Please tell me what it is. But it seems to me that all of these proposals for operations on the Iranian coastline against Iranian islands, I am not sure what exactly it is that the White House, that the administration expects that they will achieve. And I can very easily see how they could go disastrously, horribly wrong, which would, of course, only leave the United States in an even worse position than the one in which it is in already, which, to say it frankly, as of the making of this program, looks very bad. I have discussed in many programs now the chess concept of Zugzwang, the situation where you find yourself in a position in chess where whatever move you make, your position is going to get worse. In the case of Donald Trump, it seems to me that has been true for some time. But what other officials in the United States need to understand, perhaps judging from that reaction of members of Congress, some of them do, is that before long, it won't just be Donald Trump, but the United States itself, which is in a position of Zugzwang. And in that kind of situation, then even if there are no good choices, no good options, it's better to face the fact that there are only bad options, but there are some which are far worse than others. And frankly, some of these military operations that people are talking about in the Persian Gulf, as of this time, seem to me to be exactly that. Well, that's the situation as I see it today. I think, as I said, one needs to keep a calm head. The president says he wants a ceasefire. Obviously, he does. He wants to get the Strait of Hormuz open. Probably, at some level, he does understand how risky a military operation is. He has to, however, grasp that as a result of his own actions and those of his Israeli allies, the Iranians don't trust him anymore, and that is going to make negotiations far more difficult. But it still seems to me that there might be a way through to negotiations, and I've discussed how that might be done via Moscow principally, but perhaps Beijing too. And that does seem to me a far less dangerous option than some of the ground operations that people are talking about. Anyway, I say all of this. It may be that I've got something wrong. It may be that the Iranian forces are less effective in defending their ground positions than they have been in all other respects. I'm not sure why people would assume that, but maybe that is so. Anyway, we will see what happens. Now, I do want to address one final point. Colonel Douglas McGregor has discussed the question of potential use of nuclear weapons. He says that there have been warnings from Moscow to the United States and Israel that if nuclear weapons are used by either of these countries against Iran, then the Russians will become involved with their nuclear arsenal as well, or something somewhat like that. I have to say, I read the Russian media exhaustively every day. I've seen no hint of anything like this. I am convinced that the Russians are providing significant help to Iran in terms of weapons supplies, in terms of economic supplies, in terms of intelligence, in terms of technology. But, and of course we've had that comment from Lavrov a few days ago, warning about the world being in the early stages of World War III. But I don't think that the Russians are planning a nuclear war or on Iran's behalf, even if Iran is attacked with nuclear weapons. And I don't think that there's been any discussions of that sort between the Iranians and the Russians either. If nuclear weapons ever were used, it would be a cataclysm. It would be, by the way, a catastrophic political error that would backfire overwhelmingly on the users. It would also, in my opinion, be a crime, but I'm not going to discuss that possibility, a possibility like that, at this point, when I don't feel that it is imminent at the moment. Anyway, there we are. That is the situation today. There's a lot of contradictory and confusing stories, but I think if we understand that it is the clock that is running down for Donald Trump that is driving all of his and the administration's actions, then we can see the way through the maze. Let me now talk about the situation in Ukraine. And here I'm going to say that it's the opposite. I think what has been happening over the last couple of days is that because there's been a huge amount of, well, all the attention has been focused on Iran, and there's been less attention on the fighting in Ukraine, and a narrative has again begun that the Russians are stuck, that the war is not progressing, that this is a stalemate, that the Ukrainians have created an impenetrable drone wall, that this makes further Russian advances impossible. And there has been a lot of criticism in social media, and I should stress Western social media, of President Putin as a consequence of all of this. Now, a lot of this comes from the usual gaggle of Russian military bloggers and Telegram channels, many of whom are, by the way, already angry because of steps the Russian government is taking to restrict the use of Telegram. Just saying. But these people have never particularly liked President Putin. They have always considered him too soft and too weak and not as nationalist as themselves. They also like to set themselves in opposition to the Russian military leadership, to General Gerasimov in particular. Most of them were enthusiastic supporters of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the late head of the Wagner Group, who catapulted himself into a conflict with the Russian military leadership, and who briefly in 2023 actually attempted what was in effect a coup, one which unraveled immediately. And well, the tone of these people has been pretty much throughout the war that everything would be wonderful and perfect if only Putin and the Russian military listened to me. I am the person who knows how to win the war. Unfortunately, the military, Gerasimov, the general staff, President Putin, all of the others don't pay enough attention to my brilliant advice, and that is why, instead of us advancing, everything supposedly is going backwards. And well, there is that factor always at play. But at moments in the war, when things do seem to be a little quieter, that narrative gets stronger and attracts more attention, and well, is listened to and reported more about in the West. And at that point, there also tends to be, there is always a temptation to listen and accept more than usual to what the Ukrainians are saying. And of course, the Ukrainians always have an entirely understandable tendency to talk up their own position and to make it appear better than it really is. Now, in fact, the reality is that we've had quite a cascade of information from all sorts of sources. But I'm going to stick today to Russian sources, and they present a radically different picture of what's actually going on than the one, as I said, that some of these gloomy channels are coming up with. Now, let's begin with Sergei Poletayev, very, very well-informed analyst, somebody who gets quite a lot of information about the overall situation, and who publishes extensively and is listened to in Russia. And he makes a point, he says this: the Russian army has considerably reduced its combat activity, as is usual at this time of year. Typically at the end of winter and in early spring, Russian forces take the time to prepare for a new military campaign. However, just like last year, the offensive did not come to a complete stop. And that is exactly what is happening. We've had the Rasputitsa, the period of the spring thaw, and we've also had, and another Russian commentator, war reporter, Marat Khairulin, has made the same point, we also have a complete reconfiguration of Russian forces as they convert from winter conditions to spring conditions. So, for example, winter uniforms are replaced with spring uniforms. Weapons are reconfigured. Logistics are reorganized. There's rotation of forces. There's all that sort of thing. There is always something of a slowdown, though never a complete pause, in February and March. And despite claims to the contrary, in my opinion, it has been less this year than it was in the previous 2 years. But anyway, we've had more information about the situation on the battlefronts. We've had our old friend Andrei Marochko. He says that an analysis of the effectiveness of Russian strikes with high precision, long-range air-based and ground-based weapons, as well as drones, against the Ukrainian military industrial complex facilities, military depots, military airfields, and other facilities, points to a decline in the activity and effectiveness of Ukraine's air defense systems. The Ukrainians are experiencing a shortage of ammunition for their air defense systems, as well as the redeployment of some of their drone specialists to the Middle East. And Marochko goes on to say that Kiev has recently begun to use the expensive anti-aircraft missile systems and aircraft supplied by NATO countries less frequently, which is why Ukrainian drone troops are unable to cope with their assigned tasks. And elsewhere, Marochko has also said that, contrary again to what one is reading in many places, Ukrainian drone capabilities altogether are also becoming less effective. And he attributes this to new technologies that the Russians have been introducing. The main factors determining the decline in precision strikes by Ukrainian troops are new methods by the Russian armed forces to combat drones, the supply of modern anti-drone systems with AI-based guidance to Russian troops, and increased combat experience and successful development within our troops. Problems within the Ukrainian army can also be attributed to this trend, in particular the enemy's high percentage of defective cheap products and low-quality components for drones. So, according to Marochko, again, contrary to many of the reports that one is seeing, the Ukrainian drones on the battlefronts and altogether are becoming less effective. Now, recently on the Duran, we did a program with the reporter Joao Karesma. He has been visiting Russian drone schools and laboratories. He discussed, but of course did not provide us with details, of the new technologies the Russians have been working on to counter Ukrainian drones. It sounds from what Marochko is saying that some of these technologies are coming into active use and are beginning to show results. And I've speculated in recent programs that one of the reasons why, despite the massive numbers of drone strikes that the Ukrainians are conducting against targets in Russia itself, the actual effect of these strikes appears to be very limited. It could be, it possibly is, because the drone defences of the Russians are becoming better. And Marochko, by the way, also talked about the situation on the ground. He says that our soldiers are approaching Rai Alexandrovka from the southeast and beginning operations against positions of Ukrainian troops. Our soldiers have also achieved successes northeast of Rai Alexandrovka. Positions have been improved near Krivaya Luka and west of Rezinovka. This will help further advances westward. Rai Alexandrovka is a critical Ukrainian position east of Slavyansk. It is the high ground. If the Russians capture Rai Alexandrovka, they control all of the high ground around all of the key cities, all of the key towns in the Donbass belt. And in particular, they are positioned to conduct artillery strikes and drone strikes against Ukrainian supplies moving between various Ukrainian, between these various cities. So that's Marochko. There's also been further statements by other Russian commentators talking about the situation on the front lines. We've had a comment from Vitaly Kiselyov, another Russian expert whom I've discussed many times in previous programs, and he said that the Russians have now cut the Ukrainian forces in Konstantinovka in half. They've driven a wedge into their defences. In fact, there's been much to talk about this in the media, in the Russian media recently. Our wedge has broken through the defences from the east. We are expanding our area of control. The Ukrainians' logistics have been disrupted and their losses are catastrophic. And then Kiselyov also says that the Ukrainian command are disseminating fake news about Ukraine's successful attacks in Konstantinovka. And TASS reports him as saying that despite Ukrainian attacks, Russian forces continue advancing to the city's southeastern neighbourhoods. So this is what Kiselyov is saying. For the record, I believe that the biggest, most complicated battle that is taking place at the moment is the one in Konstantinovka. The difference is that if we compare with, say, the Battle of Bakhmut in 2023, during the Battle of Bakhmut, we had a running commentary about what was going on in Bakhmut from Yevgeny Prigozhin, the leader of the Wagner group. The Battle of Konstantinovka has gone on for a much shorter time than the Battle of Bakhmut. We don't have anything like that from the Russians about the situation in Konstantinovka. So though I believe that Kiselyov's account of the military situation in Konstantinovka is correct, we just don't hear about it because the Russians don't discuss it perhaps as they ought to do. I ought to say that I've been reviewing some of my old histories of the Second World War on the Eastern Front. And one of the things that baffles me is that the Russian military today are far less forthcoming about the state of military operations in the special military operation than they were in Stalin's era during the Second World War about the fighting that was taking place on the Eastern Front then. The Russians are even less good at information war, if I could put it like that, than they were at that time, which does seem remarkable. Anyway, on the negotiation issue. The Russians have made it very clear that basically they've lost interest. Witkoff and Kushner met with the Ukrainians a couple of days ago. Peskov says that it is absolutely false that Russia was close to concluding a peace agreement on Ukraine back in February, but lost interest in it after the state of the US and Israeli military operation against Iran. He says, on the contrary, that there's been some progress in the trilateral negotiations. The key issues of critical interest to the Russian side have not been agreed upon. And Putin's aide, foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, recently said exactly the same thing. He said that the Russians have been thoroughly briefed about the meeting that took place between the Americans and the Ukrainians, the one that the Russians stayed away from. Absolutely no progress was made. The Russians are completely unsatisfied by the state of the negotiations. They've not changed their position. They won't change their negotiating position. They put all the blame on the Ukrainians for the intransigence that they are showing. But in the meantime, the special military operation continues as before. I don't buy this story either, that the Russians are stuck. I hope I've explained why. I suspect that 2026 is the year when we start to see the countermeasures against the drones that the Russians have been working on start to have an effect. Usually what happens is that around midsummer we start to see proof of the big Russian breakthroughs, and there is an acceleration of Russian advances until around December. I don't see why the pattern should be any different. That was what happened in 2024 and 2025. That is what was going to happen in 2026. And, well, as for the negotiations, I think those are to all intents and purposes over. Because, to say it frankly, I don't think Donald Trump or any official in the United States has any further interest in them, given the overwhelming crisis that they're now having to contend with in their conflict with Iran. Well, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.